Hi, I'm Dr. Henry Black, a clinical professor of internal medicine at the New York University School of Medicine and immediate past president of the American Society of Hypertension. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Andrew Vickers from Sloan Kettering, talking about biostatistics in the 21st century. I want to ask you about databases, large databases that can't replace clinical trials for the reasons that we think clinical trials are better because we can control bias and we know a little bit about the individuals. But large databases with millions of individuals are grinding out more and more information. Do you think they have a place in clinical decision making?
Oh, absolutely. One of the best examples from that is the data that we're seeing on volume and outcomes. For example, if you have cancer, if you go to a surgeon who treats a lot of cancer patients, you're far likely to be cured and far less likely to have side effects than if you went to a surgeon who treated cancer as well as a number of other diseases and had a low cancer volume. That's exactly the sort of data that you can get out of these large administrative databases that it's just not something that you could get from clinical trials. It seems unlikely we'd ever do that sort of thing as a clinical
trial. One of the things that I talked about here a year or two ago was the big VA database. Do angiotensin receptor blockers cause angioedema? Was the question, the way ACE inhibitors do. And they apologized that they really couldn't answer that question because they only had 99,000 people who had gotten ARBs, whereas they had 1.5 million who had gotten angiotensin receptor blockers, who had gotten ACE inhibitors. And so 99,000 ought to give us an answer, but we still, it's really probably not the same in doing an appropriate sized trial where we gave our cohort or our volunteers one or the other to come to a conclusion.
Right. Well, you know, randomization, you never have to worry about selection. That's the purpose of randomization. You always worry in these administrative databases about selection. I mean, in the volume outcome studies, you know, a criticism for years, and this is, I think, totally wrong, but they've said, well, oh, you know, the high-volume surgeons, they select the better patients, and that's why they have the better results. If it had been a randomized trial, we never would have had that worry. Now, in the volume outcome literature, you know, it was really seen not to be a very important...
See, I would think it would be the other way around, that the high-volume surgeons are getting the worst cases.
Right, exactly. It was not really seen as a big problem. But now when you're looking at something like, does surgery or radiotherapy, is that a good treatment for early-stage prostate cancer? Maybe we can just download Medicare. You know, we know older guys get prostate cancer. We know what they're billing for, so we know what treatments they got. We can see whether they died of prostate cancer or not. How about using that instead of doing a clinical trial? We keep trying to do the clinical trials on prostate cancer. We can't get them done. You know, and there you're actually much more worried about bias, you know, because clearly men are self-selecting to different treatments and urologists are selecting who gets surgery and who gets...
Well, I was part of the SELECT study, which had selenium and vitamin E, I believe, for prostate cancer. Two arms, factorial.
Right, randomized trial.
Randomized trial, very large, with no benefit from either treatment or together against placebo.
Right.
Is that more compelling to you?
Well, you know, here's the thing is that when you have a randomized trial, you're always going to believe those results more than an observational study. The thing that you can do with these databases is do studies that you either couldn't do because they're unethical, you can do because they're too expensive. Now, one of the things is might be, say, rare adverse events. I mean, I've recently seen some ideas on using administrative databases to look for vaccine side effects, rare vaccine side effects. We're inoculating millions and millions of people to find things of very low prevalence. You're just not going to be able to do that in a randomized trial.
This brings me to another thing that's used to sort of address the same question. If I can't do mounted trial big enough, what about meta-analysis?
Sure.
Can you tell me what your criteria for good meta-analysis is and a not-so-good meta-analysis?
Right. Well, I wish it were that simple. You know, if I said, well, could you give me a criteria for a good doctor or a bad doctor? I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that you would put in there. But the main thing that you want to think about in a meta-analysis is what you're doing is you're taking the literature that's been published and you're combining that and trying to review that in some way. And just like any other study you do, that follows a protocol. If you're doing a trial, you can say, here are the patients we're going to include, and here's how we're going to analyze, you know, here's the data we're going to get from these patients, and here is the analysis we're going to do. And it's exactly the same in a meta-analysis. You say, here are the papers we're going to, here's our criteria for including papers, here are the data we're going to get from these papers, and here are of the analyses that we're going to.
So does it bother you that they start with 6,000 papers and end up talking about 15?
Right, that's very common. I've been involved in meta-analysis, and that's what you do, because you're really putting a very wide... You'd rather read through 6,000 papers and find that they're almost all inappropriate than miss some papers.
You know, the concern that we're not publishing negative data, I think, is a little bit less than it used to be, since you have to register your trial when you start.
Right, exactly.
And if it isn't registered, you can't get it published.
Right.
So I think we've dealt with that. That was the concern.
The issue of publication bias, yeah, I think it's still a worry. And what most good meta-analyses will do is that there's special tests you can look for in publication bias. For example, if a trial's big, it's going to be published whatever the results are. You know, if it's small, the chances are, if it's an amazing positive result, it's going to get published. And if it's a negative result, the authors will say, it's kind of small.
Yeah, but
we're
if
not
it's small, and it's probably not doing
that
much.
I'm not going to publish it. So what you do as a statistician, you say, is there an important difference between the results of the large trials and the small trials?
Right.
If you see that difference, then that suggests that there are some small trials that are not being published, and that would be evidence of publication bias.
We sort of have the opposite effect. There's a large prospective meta-analysis done by the hypertension trialist group, where you have to enter your data before you know the answer.
Right.
Which is the way to do it.
Absolutely. The trialist groups, data sharing, I think, is the only way to go. What you're essentially talking about there, and there's a lot of these groups, I have to give a shout out to Oxford, which is, where I did my doctorate there. They started it. Individual patient data meta-analysis. One approach to meta-analysis, the most common, is you go and get the papers and you say, let's see what blog said. Oh, blog said the odds ratio was 1.5 and Peterson said it was 1.6, so we'll combine them and that's an average of 1.55. We'll look at it that way. The alternative is to say to blogs, send me your data from your trial, and we'll get all the individual patient data, and then we will run an analysis on that ourselves. And I've been involved in those sorts of meta-analyses, and they're certainly the soundest.
Yeah, they're much better. The issue with our hypertension trialist group is it's tough sometimes to get the individual data.
Right.
And there was 160,000 volunteers in the hypertension trialist initial thing. 40,000 came from All Hat. So here you have a large study influencing the answer as opposed to small ones, which you can't really make too much. So I think there can be lots of issues with that. What's the difference between a random effects model and a fixed effects model in a meta-analysis?
Well, I'm not biased or anything, but I would say ignore the random effects because I'm a fixed effects kind of guy. But essentially what you say, a fixed effects model says, let's look at the results of the trials that we actually have in front of us and come to an average of those. The random effects model says, let's imagine that there was a hypothetical universe of a hypothetical population of trials, and the trials that we see are randomly sampled from how that breaks down statistically is that random effects models, they downweight the size the effects of large trials. Fixed effects models, they weight large trials more heavily.
Okay. Dr. Vickers, thank you very much. I think I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope you have as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me.